Hi, I'm Jeff Davis. Thanks for joining me as we head to a very familiar place for a lot of people. Let's hit the road. Today's podcast is with a guy whose name you may not recognize, but it's likely you know his product. Randy Ullum has been crafting Kendall Jackson's Vintner's Reserve Chardonnay for 25 years now. Throughout those many years, it's been the best-selling Chardonnay. That's quite a feat. Randy's been in the business for quite a while. He's long in the tooth, but you'll hear he still retains a youthful energy and wears a smile easily. Randy got inspired to get into the wine industry after a trek through Chile.
There can't be too many winemakers who can say that.
Well, that's for sure. And this was a long time ago, too. I don't really want to admit how many years ago, but it starts with a 4, and it's 2 digits. So this was back in the early days. I actually was 18 when I went down to Chile and left when I was 21. It was an exciting time in my life and, of course, in the history of Chile. But when I went there, I went there to go skiing, and I did not realize that it was a wine country, like number 10 on the wine countries in the world. And I liked wine. I was the sort of the odd man out back in America, or here in America back then. Everybody liked beer at that age. And when I got down there and realized that they had all these different kinds of wines, and after spending 3 years there and really learning about, what the country had to offer and meeting people who explained about, the viticulture and winemaking and sales, and then being taught by some other friends about wines of the world and then the food and the cuisine and how all that worked. When I left, I thought, geez, I've got to get into this business. I got to get paid to taste.
Right. Boy, what an education. But what kept you down there for 3 years? Were you just trying to learn a little bit about the business?
I actually went down just for, it was a 3-month trip to South America. The first month was going to be just in Chile to go skiing. And there was a very unique situation going on there. It was a democratically elected socialist government quickly going to communism. So it was like the Wild West. And the economy was something that you rarely ever get to experience, 1,000% inflation. There's some interesting things that go along with that. It was too exciting to leave. I just had to cherish this. And so that 1 month in Chile ended up being 3 years.
So you do make it back home, and you entered the Enology program at Ohio State. And I don't think I've ever talked with a winemaker who went to Ohio State. But that's not terribly surprising, because Ohio was one of the first successful wine regions in the U.S.
Absolutely. When you think about the East Coast and the east side of the Midwest, that area encompasses Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Missouri, New York, and using the Great Lakes as a way to moderate the cool temperatures in the winter and to extend the growing season, it's a great area for that. And of course, the Concord grape kind of emanated from Concord, Massachusetts, near Lexington and Boston, the birthplace of America. So you have this Vitis Americana style of grapes. They don't make the best wine in the world, to tell you the truth, but it is a viticultural area, and there are wineries there, and everybody's trying. So what I learned first out of school is if you can grow grapes, for starters, in that inclement climate, and then make some wine out of it, you can do that anywhere in the world.
And then you ended up going up to Upper New York State. And that wine region is actually doing quite well right now.
It is. So my first job was outside of Cleveland in Ohio, right along Lake Erie. And then that was for 1 year. And then I went up to New York for 5 years, along the same lake, kind of through Pennsylvania and up towards Westfield, New York. And I was there for 5 years and then decided that it was kind of like a dead-end street there. Actually, before I went to New York, I came to California to look for a job, and actually was offered a job, ironically, at Buena Vista. And that was at the end of a 5-year drought, and being from the east where everything's green and lush, and then you come out to, this dry, arid state of California that everybody talks about, and it was dusty and dirty, and I thought, how could anyone in their right mind live here? And so I actually turned the job down and went back and worked the 5 years in New York, and then realized maybe I need to go try it again in California, and landed a job and had a different mindset. Now the hills are not dirty, dusty brown. They're golden.
Yes, and plenty of green vineyards too. And this was 1981, and you were working at Deloge.
That is correct. I was hired by Cecil and Christine Deloach in the day, just as they were getting started. It was basically the first year of them going into being a production winery, or maybe the second year. But we started out really small and grew to well over 100 plus thousand cases. And we specialized in Chardonnay and then, of course, Pinot and Zinfandels. And just had a great time doing it. When I started, it was so small that one third of my job was driving the tractor in the vineyard. The other third was acting as a carpenter, helping to build all the new parts to the winery, and one third in the winery. And then as we grew, each piece started dropping off until ultimately, it was a full time and a half winemaking job there.
Yeah, you became winemaker and vice president, I understand.
Exactly, and that was an honor to be promoted up to vice president. It's a good family-run winery. We had a lot of fun together, and growing through in all the different phases of life that you go through in a fast-growing winery setting is very, very exciting. Every year is different.
I want to make sure people understood what you said a minute ago, that you took that winery from about 10,000 cases to 120,000 cases in the time you were there. That's huge growth.
Right. Well, we were very fortunate because we had some, obviously being in Sonoma County, West County, it was great for Chardonnay and Pinot, and we were making some very nice Chardonnays. Well, all the wines were nice, but our Chardonnay is what was sort of our flagship there. And it just kept, you couldn't make enough of it. It was amazing.
Is that what caught the eye of Jess Jackson while you were there? Did he see what you were doing, and did he offer you a job?
Yeah, he offered me a job twice, actually. Once I wasn't ready to leave, and then the second time I was thinking, maybe it's time to try something new. And it was basically because of the Chardonnay. We had turned out to be very similar, if not almost identical, palates, especially for Chardonnay. And then the other was he learned that I had been in Chile and loved Chile and liked to travel back and forth to Chile, and he was dying to have someone go down to Chile and create a new brand and open a winery down there for him. So it was a match made in heaven.
Yeah, I saw that, and I was going to ask you, as you noticed in my questions, that did he know that you had that inspirational background years before?
He did. Absolutely.
But you did a lot of other things in that first year you were there, which was 1991. He had you go up to Mendocino and reopen Ed Mead's. Then you got involved with the Camelot label in Central California, and then you went to Chile. So,
right. Yeah,
that was a busy year for you.
That was like all in the span of 3 months. First Santa Barbara and get that show on the road, and then up to Mendocino and Ed Mead's and get that going. And then by Thanksgiving, a trip down to Chile, kind of figure out the game plan there. And then the following February, we crushed our first grapes in Chile. So it was bing, bang, boom.
What was his desire to work in Chile so early on at that time?
Well, there were two reasons. One, Jess wanted to become a world company and not just make wine in California and America. He wanted to expand. So he had a whole game plan, which we can get into in a minute. But Chile really is just like California, off by 6 months. So you have the Pacific, you have the Humboldt Current, you've got the cold Pacific. So the cool coast of Chile is like the cool coast of California, where all the fine grapes are grown, and you have all these different areas going from north to south. And he figured at some point there's going to be a limitation on great grape-growing land in California, which there already is, and where do you go to continue that same vein? Well, to emulate California, it's Chile. And so that was the rationale, to be able to continue and perpetuate that. But then, so to continue on, then Jess really, he had this whole vision. And so when I came, he had just purchased a large chunk of land in Italy, and so there was a couple hundred acres of vineyard, and we were redeveloping that and getting that going in the Chianti area. We had a project in northern Italy, a project down in the Boot. We had a project going on in the south of France. That we decided not to continue with that. We focused on basically Chianti in Italy. He sent me to Argentina. We opened a winery, or built a winery and purchased a bunch of land and developed vineyards there, which we subsequently sold when they had their financial crisis. But then off I went to Australia to create Yangara, and then that's plenty.
What a great career you have. But at that time, which was years ago, you're probably thinking, man, I've reached the pinnacle here of winemaking.
But yeah, you would think that, and I'm very blessed and very honored, for sure. But then Jess asked me to take over Kendall Jackson. They said, well, Andy, you need to stay home a little bit more. You can't quite travel that much and focus on KJ. And, of course, we have all these different tiers at Kendall Jackson and a lot of vineyards, over probably 13,000 acres or so, 12,000 back then, up and down just the coast of California. So it's Mendocino, Napa, Sonoma, Lake County, Monterey, and Santa Barbara. But spectacular vineyard sites and wineries in each place and different vineyard managers and all these different flavors and varieties that are grown. So it's quite the challenge.
And as you mentioned, you both had a great palate for Chardonnay, and he had this idea to make a wonderful tasting Chardonnay that most of America could afford. And that went off really well, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a home run, actually, because you didn't need to have a PhD to understand what you were drinking. It was pleasant, pleasurable. It smelled good. It tasted good. It had a nice, creamy, long finish. It just beckoned for another sip. It brought a smile to everyone's face, and they just couldn't stop sipping and drinking it, and the rest is history.
Now, do I understand that it has been the top-selling Chardonnay for 24 years now?
It's actually now 25 years. Number one selling Chardonnay in America. We're very, very proud of that. And it's all barrel fermented. Well, 95% barrel fermented for the Vintner's Reserve, which is a feat in itself. But it's a testament to the quality.
Now, it's got to be a challenge to make that taste the same year in and year out, because that's what that consumer is expecting. How do you handle that?
The part of the trick to that is the ratio of the grapes from the different areas along the coast. And we try to keep that more or less similar, and since we own and supply the majority of all the grapes that we use, it's very easy to do that. As long as we can maintain those percentages, because you get a different flavor from each area. So as an example, up Mendocino gives you the crisp green apple tone. The part of the Russian River gives you ripe apple. Carneros, the pear tones and pear oil. And then you go down to Monterey and you get the lemon and the lime, the citrine character. And then the part of the Chardonnay that comes from Santa Barbara is the tropical, like pineapple-y tone. So if you can maintain those, you know, ratios more or less, you can keep it going year in and year out because you've got the same source. And then you maintain your barrel ferment and your ratios of new oak and not get too crazed with the oak part. It's not that challenging.
Yeah. I think you can get that for like $17.
Well, yeah, that's what we call the MSRP, manufacturer suggested retail price. More often than not, if you're in California, it's $10, $12, $14, at your local stores. Pretty good deal.
Okay, I'd like to interject here. I have to admit, it had been many years since I had a Kendall Jackson Vintner's Reserve Chardonnay, but after hearing Randy describe the flavors, I was inspired to hit a grocery store on the way home. And it was about $12. And yes, it's an affordable wine, but you can taste each of those flavors. It's silky, without much oak or buttery flavors, and I could taste why it sells so well.
The challenging part is putting the blend together because we keep all the lots separate. So we'll have over 1,000 different lots that we're trying to taste and manage. And that's more of the challenge, is working with all those lots.
But somehow you have to remember year after year after year when you're doing the blending what the end result's going to be.
Well, you project what that end result is going to be, and you compare it to what you've already done. And you're constantly, when you're tasting all these wines, thinking, well, what do we need to do? So a little bit more butter, malolactic, a little bit more toast. Of course, we stir the lees on everything. But it's a challenge for sure. We kind of, wax eloquence over all this. It's a piece of cake. But it is a tactical challenge.
And I'm sure plenty of note-taking and reading.
A lot of notes are taken, that's for sure. And we have a great team. We couldn't do this without the team that we have. And a lot of the folks on the winemaking team have been with us for 20-plus years also. So it becomes just second nature after you've done it for a number of years.
So tell us about Jess Jackson. What was the guy like? I mean, he was obviously driven. And he must have done well in the 80s to be able to afford all that he did in the 90s.
Well, he did well. I mean, Jess was just a regular old guy. He was an attorney that sort of fell into making wine and having a winery. He was an attorney until he was 50, and he had purchased a piece of land up in Lake County just to go for weekends because he lived in San Francisco with his family, and it had some grapes, and he planted some more grapes. And this was probably in the 70s, and he was selling his production every year to Barney Fetzer. in that neck of the woods. And then there was the grape, one of many grape crises, and this was in the 78, I believe, thereabouts. And so Barney canceled his contract, and all of a sudden there's Jess with all these grapes, and he's figuring, I'll be damned if I'm going to let them hang on the vine and rot. So he decided to make wine out of them. Made some wine that went okay. So then the next year he made more wine and actually bottled it, and he bought other grapes, some from vineyards that we still are sourcing from today, talking about continuity from day one in Monterey and Santa Barbara. So he bought some other grapes and decided to make some wine. It was like 18 or 20,000 cases, and it was a wonderful Chardonnay. And he decided he decided to be the, you know, the winemaker. He was the PR guy, he was the marketing guy, and he was the sales guy. And so he went off to
and already up to 19,000 cases.
That's out of the gate.
That's not small.
No, but he was a gambler, believe it or not. You'd never see him in a casino, but he would gamble with life and on these strategies. And he was sharp as a tack. He had this infectious energy and vitality and enthusiasm, always with a smile, always challenging you, but just the nicest guy with the biggest heart and an incredible palate. And he had a palate that was consumer-friendly. And that's why the wine really was a success. So he took that, you know, that first year's production and sold it, and decided, huh, I'm getting out of the, you know, the law business. I'm gonna start this. And so it just started growing and growing. He didn't walk into this with a huge sum of money that was just given to him or a windfall. He started from scratch. And worked his way up through all this, and his success. He kept investing everything into the company, into the land, because he loved the land. That's where his heart and soul was. So he was adamant about being in charge of his own destiny.
Yeah, I knew he was a lawyer. I'm sure he had a successful career as a lawyer, but yeah, that doesn't give you the amount of money to kick up a winery. So he must have been very smart at what he did.
Well, he is highly intelligent, and Barbara Banky is highly intelligent also. And the two of them made a formidable team, and Barbara is carrying on the tradition, you know, and then some of what just started. But he was very tactical, and you know, when the market would go to the right, he'd go to the left, and it was always the right move. And he was in the right place at the right time for so many things. And people really thought, oh my God, who is this maverick out there? And took the world by storm.
Yeah, he was kind of one of the newer of that generation, wasn't he? I mean, you had Mondavi, and you had a few others along the way, but he sure made a name for himself.
Very, very quickly, because we're only 35 years old. Imagine that, you know, from zero to where we are today as a company, and starting with Kendall Jackson as the first label, and then came Cambria. Then, of course, they purchased Ed Meads, and now as a group, you know, Jackson Family Wines, we have pushing 50 different brands around the world, and a lot up and down the state of California, and we've ventured into Oregon too. So it's quite quite exciting. And the neat thing is, every brand has its own identity, its own way of making the wines, its own winemaker. Everything is kept separate. And a lot of people think, oh, you know, we've gotten big and we just have gigantic tanks and this, that, and the other thing. We're the complete opposite. We started small, and we still have a small winery mentality on keeping everything separate and then ultimately blending things together. But it's pretty, pretty darn cool.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you, how do you oversee all of that? Because it's huge. You mentioned over 50 or close to 50 properties and brands. And I thought it was 30-something, but you're way beyond that.
Oh, way beyond. I mean, it just keeps growing. But we have a tremendous people, tremendous team, and you know, the winemakers, the general managers, the vineyard managers, the guys, you know, in the vineyard, you know, tending to the vines, and the cellar crew, and then of course a fantastic leadership team here. So it's just grown and grown and grown and keeps on growing.
You're just the long gray-haired wizard who sits up on the hill just making sure everything is running smoothly, aren't you?
Well, we try. I mean, we have our ways, but the bottom line to all of this is quality. And over-delivering, basically. And quality trumps everything. Every conversation, if somebody get into it with, like, the finance guys on how much something costs, you know, would come down to, okay, here are two glasses of wine. Should we discuss this ourselves, or should we let Jess make the decision? And at the end of the day, it was quality prevailed, no matter what. And that's what's really gotten us to where we are now. It's being a family-run company. It's not about, you know, the next quarter's income statement or what have you, because we have all the shareholders, like a public company. And we have one shareholder, that's Barbara. And effectively, you know, you can stop on a dime and turn on a dime. And a division, which is from a winemaker's perspective, always having the best land, the best grapes, the best people, the best winery, the best equipment to make the best wines possible, but with a vision. You know, and it's not just a one-year vision. It's 20, it's 50, it's 100. Sometimes it's the vision, believe it or not. It's 200 years, and we'll all be dead. But they're planning for the future generations. It's quite an honor.
As they have in Burgundy and Italy, and they've been doing that for centuries.
Right, and so when we're 500 years old, we'll still be around. You know, Jackson Family Wines, with Lord knows how many little Jackson grandchildren or great-grandchildren running around, but I would love to be able to look back somehow, you know, if I were going to be alive, you know, 250 years from now, to see how it was. But I know it'll be fantastic.
Well, if you are the wizard, maybe you will be alive.
One never knows. We might find that secret.
Aside from the great list of brands they own, you may not realize that if you're not a club member or have been to the tasting room, the Kendall Jackson brand has a number of different tiers of wine, from the affordable to the level of a luxury brand. So I asked Randy to take us through the different tiers they offer.
So we at Kendall Jackson, we have what we call our broad market wines that are, you know, sold across the country and around the world, which is the Vintner's Reserve tier. And we have all, you know, the major varieties there: Pinot, Zin, Syrah, Cab, Chardonnay, Merlot, things like that. And then Sauvignon Blanc and Riesling also. Then we have the Grand Reserve. And the Grand Reserve is our favorite lots that would represent, you know, if you're going to try to figure it out numerically, it's the top 6% of a given variety of our favorite lots will go into the Grand Reserve. And then we have, and the Grand Reserve will be more county-based or even Appalachian-based. And then we have what are called the Jackson Estate Appellation tier and the Jackson Estate Vineyard tier. The Appalachian tier is, there's only three: the Pinot from Anderson Valley and Mendocino, Chardonnay from the Santa Maria Valley and Santa Barbara, and a Cabernet from the Alexander Valley and Sonoma. That's only for restaurants. And then we have their sister tier, which would be those same areas but from a specific vineyard: Camelot for the Chardonnay, Hawkeye for the Cab, and Outland Ridge for the Pinot. And so those are, you know, limited, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 cases kind of thing for sort of what we call the three-tier system, you know, anywhere. And then we also have the very pinnacle of our winemaking endeavors. It's called Stature. And that's a Cabernet that is a mountain-based cab from Knights Valley and the Alexander Valley, but of vineyards of elevation. In fact, all of the vineyards, well, 85% of the vineyards that we own are from either mountains, ridges, hillsides, or benches. We really don't like or have any vineyards in the true valley floor because they're too productive for us. We're looking for concentration and lower yields. So those are the tiers that we have. In the Stature, we have a Cabernet and a Chardonnay. And that basically does it. So we go from, you know, maybe a million and change-ish cases for our Chardonnay to Vintner's Reserve Chardonnay to like 80 cases maybe for the Stature Chard.
Yeah.
We have the gamut in both volumetrics, quality, and price.
And price, yes. Yes. So I was going to ask you about that. I'm glad you brought that up, the Kendall Jackson Vintner's Reserve Chardonnay. You're over a million cases?
Yes, and change. Yeah, and very quite proud of it.
And this mindset of getting away from that buttery, oaky Chardonnay is not affecting you guys very much?
No, I mean, we never went there. So, you know, we have a kiss of butter, a kiss of oak. There was a period of time where everybody thought the more oak, the better. But we have not changed that for years. We've just held our way, and, you know, we're very, very reliant upon oak barrels, for sure. But it's the fermentation part and a kiss of toastiness. But to the degree that we're half owners of a stave mill over in France to guarantee and ensure the quality of our barrels and the age of our barrels and the source of our barrels, the oak, sourcing oak in France by the different forests is kind of like sourcing Chardonnay in California by the different appellations and regions. You get different nuances from each forest.
Well, that's great that you have part ownership, because that's certainly creating consistency and sticking with it.
That's, yeah, another one of our secrets.
So you've been at it a long time. Are you thinking about like a lot of winemakers do, I'm going to eventually just get away from the big corporate world and just make my own little wine and have my own label before I give it up.
You know, a lot of people ask me that, and I've been very fortunate, very blessed to do what I've done here at Kendall Jackson and with Jess. You know, I've gone off and basically started wineries from scratch. I do all of those as if they are my own, but for him and the company. So I've done so many of those that I don't need to go out and experience that again on my own. So I'm content, and I've focused on making, you know, small little lots. We do direct to consumer lots that nobody sees unless they come to our wine center, and our the guys I work with work on them. We have our special wines we all have a chance to do. So I feel completely fulfilled already, having worked all these years at with the Jackson family.
Well, I sure appreciate your time and sharing your story with us.
Oh, it's an honor and a pleasure. And it's always fun to, you know, let people know a little bit more about the wine world and what goes on and how people got started. And it's just everybody in the wine business and the food business and the restaurant business, everybody's so kind and wonderful and always happy for some reason.
I wonder why that is. Yeah, I tell you, I have the joy doing this job and talking with people, and all of you are all very approachable, and I love sharing your stories because they're all so unique.
All unique, and everybody in the you know, basically the wine business, be it the grape side or the wine side, are very down-to-earth people, salt of the earth, and that's what it takes.
Randy Ullum, the wine master of the entire Kendall Jackson portfolio. You can see his photo, read more about him, and learn a lot more about Kendall Jackson at simplykj.com. If you're listening to this on iTunes or another podcast provider, you can learn more about my show at onthewineroad.com and on Facebook as well. I'm on Instagram under the name JD Wineroad and on Twitter at JD Wineroad. I'm Jeff Davis. Thanks for listening to this podcast of On the Wine Road.